Hello and welcome for computer graphics. So last week we started by having a look at the what we call the rendering pipeline, number of steps that are necessary to generate 3D images. And as I said last time, we will now dive into details for parts of this pipeline. And today we are going to look at the lighting stage. And just to remind you, this was the very simplified, very first version of the rendering pipeline. So in the beginning, we have a scene of 3D objects, a 3D description of the scene, usually triangle meshes that describe the surface, the geometry of the object. Today, we will also learn what other attributes we will give these objects that describe how light is reflected by these objects. So these 3D objects are then transformed to image space. So this is a camera simulation. Yeah, the triangles of the original objects are transformed to image space so that we have image space triangles. These are then rasterized. So we find all the pixels that lie within such a triangle. And to these pixels now, we have to assign a color. And this is what we call lighting. And this is what we will speak about today. Yeah, so we are in this final stage here. So the challenge is the following. So we rasterize the triangle. This, maybe you remember that picture. That's also from the introduction. So you can still recognize the shape of a triangle, even if it's a bit blocky. And now imagine the situation. We found that this pixel is within the triangle, and now we want to find a color for that particular pixel. Yeah? In that case, some pinkish color. Okay, so as I said, this means that we have to simulate lighting. So to get such a color, we have the following mental model. We have a particular point on that triangle. So we just take the pixel center. Yeah, this represents a particular point in 3D space on a triangle. Additionally, we have one or multiple light sources in the scene. For now, we will have one. The extension to multiple light sources is very simple. So we have a single light source in the scene. This light source illuminates that point. And then light is reflected towards the camera. So this is our virtual camera. When rendering a scene, we have a virtual camera positioned somewhere with whatever other parameters, view direction and stuff like that. Yeah, so we know we look at that point from this direction. This is important because surface points change their appearance if you look at them from different points of view. Yeah, so we also need to know what is the direction we are looking at, this point, and we know the light sources. Yeah, so essentially this describes what we have to compute now. We have a point in 3D space, light sources, and a single camera, and now we want to find out what color does this point have under this illumination here. So just as a remark here, so if you do the programming tutorials, what most of you do, I think, you will learn that this lighting computation is usually computed in a shader. So that means whatever tool you use for rendering, the typical way to describe these lighting computations is that you have the possibility to provide a little piece of code that exactly does this computation. So this piece of code is executed for each of these pixels. And as input, it gets, for instance, the positions of the light sources, view direction, and so on in whatever format. So I won't go into detail here. You will learn that in the programming tutorials. And then there's a little piece of code that computes a color for that. That's what we call shader. Yeah? And this is a very simple shading program. written in GLSL, that's the shading language of OpenGL, and you will also write such code in the programming tutorials. And maybe if you look at it, you will quickly recognize it's very similar to C. It has, these shading languages have more sophisticated types for doing such lighting computations. For instance, they have three-dimensional vectors. They also have four-dimensional vectors. They have all the linear algebra that you need for these computations, like matrix, vector multiplication, cross product, and stuff like that. Yeah, so it's a special language for that particular purpose of lighting computations. Yeah, and then we have a little piece of code. That's the main method that takes no parameters. So parameter passing in light directions and stuff like that works in a different way by having here global variables. And then essentially what we have to do is compute such a color here. So this GL frag color, that's just a predefined variable that you have to set in that program. And now this is a very simple lighting method. It's diffuse lighting. We will learn about that today. It's a diffuse lighting method, and that computes diffuse lighting and returns that here as that color. So you don't need to understand that here at that point. I just wanted to mention, keep in mind, later on, you will have to transfer this, what we learn here in theory, to such a shader program, and you can then, this shader program here defines the appearance of your objects. Okay, so back to theory. What do we have to compute? So lighting computation means that you simulate how light propagates through the environment, and in particular, it's interesting to simulate how light propagates from the light sources to the camera or to the eye. Yeah? So only a very, very small fraction of the photons emitted by such a light will arrive in the eye. But in particular, these few photons we are interested in. And we don't do the simulation in the way that we emit photons from here and wait until they hit the eye. That's far too complicated. It would be possible, but it is far too complicated. So we have to find other ways. And what we will also do in the beginning is that we only take a very simple class of paths, of light paths. And these are the paths where a photon emanates from the light, is reflected once, and then comes to the eye. Yeah? So this is only direct light. And we will concentrate on this. And later on, we will learn how these more complicated paths, where there are multiple bounces in between, how they can also be simulated, but that's much more complicated. Okay, so for now, we really have we are in the situation, we have a particular point, that's what we are looking at. Yeah? So we are looking at that point, so if we go back to that image, yeah? So we know when doing the rasterization, we see that point. Yeah? So we are looking at that point here. That's a rasterized pixel. We know we see that point, and we know where the light sources are. Yeah? So we know the geometrical setup. We have a light source, a point that reflects light, and we have a camera. Okay, and now we somehow have to find rules how for this simple setup light is reflected. And the first thing to do is that we look into a physics literature and see how this problem is described in physics, typically. And you will quickly find that the following possibilities, or that we have to look at the following possibilities. So number one, a light source emits light and it hits a point, and the light is simply absorbed. Yeah? So the darker a surface is, the more light will be absorbed. Okay, that's simple. The other possibility is that light is reflected like from a mirror. Yeah, so you have a perfect mirror, that means that the angle or the input angle is the same as the output angle, or the angle of incidence is the same angle as the angle of excitance. That's the typical mirror thing. Okay, then in practice, yeah, objects are not really perfect mirrors. They have a more rough appearance. So this typically happens because the surface, even if we model it as flat or as smooth, it has a microstructure, yeah, that it has some roughness in it. And this microstructure, as a result, light is not reflected like here from this mirror, but instead there are multiple reflections within this microstructure, and light is scattered not only into reflection direction, but in arbitrary directions. Okay, that's what we will call scattering. And then another two effects that we won't look much into in the first half of that lecture is refraction. So for transparent surfaces like glass or water, light also penetrates the medium or the surface and is reflected at that step, refracted at that step. And there are laws to describe that by using optical density or whatever. I'm pretty sure you learned about that in physics. And yeah, there's another, I don't even know whether this really happens in physics. Another effect that we call transmission is that light just passes through without changing direction. Okay, so these are kind of effects that that we will also describe now or use in the rest of this lecture. Okay, so to summarize the what is given, yeah? So assume, or what is given? A point on an object. Yeah? So we have our triangle in the scene. This is rasterized. We get a particular pixel. So we have a triangle in the world. This is mapped to the screen. Then we rasterize this pixel here. We take the center point of that pixel that corresponds to this point in 3D space. Yeah? So this point we will call X. Then we will also need a surface normal for that point. So that surface normal is just a vector that is perpendicular to the surface at X. Yeah? So we need that to know the orientation of our surfaces. Okay, so this is for the reflection point. And then we have a number of light sources. Yeah, so this is our light source. And for this light source, we typically also have a position, P. And additionally, we have all these light sources have intensities. Yeah? So that's just how bright they are. And later on, this will also contain color. So the intensity, the amount of emitted light, is L. And since we can have multiple of them, we add an index I. OK, so this, what I showed here, is a point light. So that means light comes from a single particular point in space. An alternative are parallel lights. So typically, the sun is modeled as a parallel light source. And that means light does not really come from a point in 3D space, but from infinitely far away. So all the incident light comes just from a given direction. Yeah? So this is what we call parallel light. OK, and finally, we have a viewer position. That's the position of the virtual camera from which we are looking at that point. Yeah? So if we remove that here, now we have that very simple setup. Yeah, this is given. This is the viewing direction or viewer position is V, the light position is PI, and the point we want to illuminate is X. Okay, and now I already spoke about that last time. Yeah, now we want to compute how light really is coming from here is reflected here, going to here, and we only look at direct reflection. So we don't take into account other light paths where light is scattered multiple times and so on. This is what is called the global illumination problem. That's the much more complicated one. And we will now look only for local illumination. And local illumination really means three points, yeah, and that's it. Okay. Yeah, this is just another, set this again. So we don't take inter-reflection in account and stuff like that. Of course, it would be is better to have global illumination, but it's a question of time that is available. Local illumination is much, much simpler, but it lacks important effects. So stuff like, for instance, shadows are not included, yeah, because if there's another object here in between, yeah, we just ignore that for the moment. Or indirect illumination, or perfect reflection, mirroring, and stuff like that, that's all not included. But it's a typical illumination model, and if you do standard OpenGL-based rendering, then you always have local illumination. Okay, and global illumination has much more complicated effects. It includes indirect illumination, so light exchange between the objects themselves, more complicated light sources. So for now, we always assume that our light sources are points, which in reality, of course, is not true. Light sources have a certain extent. So we don't look at that. We don't look at shadows. And in fact, this makes it very slow, but also gives much higher quality. And the typical method to achieve these effects are ray tracing. And we will look at ray tracing in the second half of this lecture. Okay. So before we look at the models here to describe that, let me briefly have a look at color or at a physical description of light, because, of course, this is very important for that step. As you probably know, light is just electromagnetic radiation, and there's a large spectrum of this radiation, and only a subband of that radiation is perceived by the human eye as light. So with wavelengths between 400 and 700 nanometers, that is what we receive as light. And of course, this wavelength or frequency, that's essentially the same, we perceive as color. So here with these low wavelengths, this is the violet or the blue colors. And the higher the wavelength, the larger the wavelength gets, the more we come to red. And if you see a rainbow, you can exactly see that spectrum. Yeah? It shows you exactly the spectrum, the visible spectrum of colors. Okay, so electromagnetic waves, the frequency gives you the color, and the amplitude gives you the intensity. Yeah? So you can have very bright red and dark red. So this is the amplitude. And photons are just another way to describe light. So probably you know that it's not possible to say light is waves or photons. It's both. Both representations are valid. And photons is just a particle model for light. Yeah? So every photon is very small and has very, very little energy, but it has a particular frequency. And it carries a certain amount of energy. And sometimes we will also use the model to describe light as photons. And in other parts, we will describe light as waves and use whatever is more appropriate for our purpose. So here the colors again, an overview here. You see all the rainbow colors. And here shown again on such a bar here. Good. So the interesting thing now is that our eye is pretty bad in perceiving colors. So the world is much more colorful than we perceive it. And in fact, our eyes only have three different receptors for color. And what these receptors do is that if you have the entire spectrum of visible color, So that's from here, from 400 nanometers to 700. And now you have a certain color, a certain amount of light, or a certain light source that maybe has this spectrum. Yeah, so it has a peak here around it, green, but it also has many more colors. And now you have three different receptors in your eye, and they, what they do is that they are just perceive or have different, or they perceive the different frequencies differently. So there's one receptor. Okay, it's probably, this curve is not correct, but there's one receptor that reacts to incident frequencies like this. So it has a focus on blue. Then there's another receptor that mainly receives green, and one for red. These curves are wrong, but just should give you an idea. And as a result, yeah, you kind of can describe, at a certain point, you have a response of the red receptor, one of the green, and one of the blue receptor. So this entire spectrum is just described by three values. Yeah, I'm sure you know that, but I think it's worth to have a look at that again. And of course, that also means that it is possible that you have very different spectra that all result in the same RGB values. Yeah, and it's also interesting to notice that these receptors here, or this frequency ranges overlap. And yeah, this will have interesting effects for rendering, which we will come back to later. Okay, so a large spectrum of possible colors, but we only perceive a three-dimensional subspace of that. Yeah, and typically we call them red, green, and blue, So we describe such a complex spectrum just by these three values, R, G, and B. And there are interesting things now to notice. For instance, if we add red and green, we get yellow. And in that case, you have to be careful. This means additive color mixing. Essentially, that means take a red light bulb and take a green light bulb and go so far away that you cannot resolve them spatially so that they become one light bulb for you, and then you will recognize that the resulting color is yellow. It's the same effect that is used on your TFT. Yeah, here you have per pixel, in each of the pixels of your screen, you have four subpixels, typically a red one, two green ones, and a blue one. And if you turn on red and green, you get yellow. Yeah, because you just don't see the subpixels, you just perceive that as one pixel, and this pixel then gives you the color yellow. And the same, if you add green and blue, you get cyan, and blue and red gives you magenta. And red and green and blue, oops, probably that disappeared here, altogether this gives white. Yeah, and that means that's a spectrum that is ideally constant. This is white color, yeah, that has a uniform distribution over all colors. And that's typically sunlight is pretty white. And you know that different light sources now have different characteristics and not a perfect white spectrum. So typical old light bulbs more have a reddish spectrum, and neon lights like these are more greenish and so on. Okay, good. So this results in a color model, which we call the RGB color model. And this just tells us, yeah, how much does our red receptors perceive, the green receptors, and the blue receptors. And the other way around, how much should I activate the red subpixel, the green subpixels, and the blue subpixels to generate exactly this color, or a color that is perceived by human observer as the right color. And in this color model, so we have a triple of values. So all values typically, or for now we will say, are between 0 and 1. That doesn't make sense to have an upper bound, yeah? Because light can be arbitrarily high. So it doesn't make sense to have an upper bound 1. 1 is typically interpreted as the maximum value that your monitor can show. And if you, so all the possible colors then lie within that unit cube. And now here you can say 0, 0, 0 is black. All activated means color white. And then these points here on the main axis are red, green, and blue. And here we have the mixed colors, yellow, cyan, and magenta. OK, so that's the description of color. But additionally, of course, here we also have the kind of intensity. Yeah, so if we multiply all these values by 2, our pixel will have the same color, but it will be just twice as bright. Yeah. So that's all a bit mixed. Typically, these colors, if we store RGB colors, we don't store them as floating point values or whatever, but in a more compact format, because we have many of these pixels in an image. And they are typically stored at a resolution of 8-bit. So this gives you values between 0 over 255 up to 255 over 255. So you have 256 different steps. And on some displays, if you have a close look, you can even recognize the transition, in particular for the dark colors. So you see the difference between 0 and 1. Yeah? 0 over 255 and 1 over 255. So it's a finer discretization would make sense. And there are displays that allow for a finer resolution, but they're quite expensive. So it's still kind of state of the art that you have 256 levels for each of these. OK. So much on color, yeah, and the representations of all these intensity values and color values. You can always think that they are RGB triples. We won't say that explicitly in the following, and just speak about intensity or something like that. We will learn about the proper units later on. Okay, so again, here the situation. Yeah, this is our setup, and what we want to compute is how light from the light source goes to the camera. I already described that. So we have two kinds of light sources, directional light sources. That means that light comes from a particular direction. So essentially, the light source is infinitely far away, like the sun, which is it's a good approximation that it's infinitely far away. What was that? Okay. And this light source is described just by the direction vector L. And for a point light source, this is just the position in 3D space. And if we, for a particular point here, we want to have the direction towards the light source, yeah, we just have to compute that explicitly. Yeah, so we have to compute the vector from P or from X to P and normalize that. And this gives us our light direction. Yeah, from then on, we don't have to make a difference between directional and point light. We just say light at X comes from direction L. And one thing that is maybe a bit intuitive, but very helpful, because it helps you to avoid a lot of minus signs, is that the direction towards the light source goes from the point to be lit to the light source. So it goes in opposite photon direction. Yeah? It's not this direction here, but the direction to the light source. And I will use that consistently, and it's the way to do it. Everybody does so. Good. So these are the two major light sources. Just to be complete, there are other light sources. One is our so-called spotlights. And here the idea is that it's a point light, but it only illuminates a cone or a spot. Yeah, so you have a spot direction and an opening angle. So you can see that as a cone here. And everything or outside that cone, it generates no light, but only inside that cone. So it's like a spotlight. Yeah, and there are ways to define a decay at the boundary and stuff like that. So there are many ways to describe different kinds of lights, but essentially it's still a point light. Yeah, it just outside that cone, the illumination is turned off. But it's nothing fundamentally different. Fundamentally different are area light sources. So these are light sources that have an extent. And as a result, they don't generate, for instance, they generate softer illumination. We will speak about that later. And in particular, they make a very big difference when it comes to shadows. But we don't speak about that yet. So for now, we only have point lights. Okay, and the typical lighting model to describe the illumination by such point lights is the Phong lighting model. And this lighting model is purely heuristic. So it's really from the very ancient times of computer graphics. And this guy Phong, where the nice story is, Korean? Yeah, some Asian guy. And in fact, Phong is the first name. Yeah, but since first and second name are swapped, and the Americans or the Europeans thought Phong is the second name, so it's the Phong lighting model. So in German, it would be the Heinz lighting model. Yeah. Okay, but it's very widely used, and it's purely heuristic, it has the big advantage that it's easy to evaluate. And has very simple and intuitive parameters, but it generates a very typical look. It cannot model every surface that we see in nature. Yeah, so it works very well for plastic. That's it. So it's a very plastic-like look. But it's a kind of de facto standard in computer graphics. And the idea is very simple, and there is some relation to physics. And that's that light, reflected light, is composited from three terms that are simply added, and that's the ambient light, the diffuse reflection, and the specular reflection. And I will now just briefly go through these three. Ambient light is... it's a way to... in fact, it's the most simple one and probably most difficult to explain. Ambient light describes the fact that a point is typically not only lit directly by the light source, but also indirectly. Yeah? So we saw that picture several times before now. And because it's very difficult to simulate that indirect illumination, yeah. What is done in that model is that the indirect illumination is just simplified by a common term, yeah, some ambient intensity. That's just intensity or light that arrives at that point by the surrounding. And now ambient light just models that one. And every surface can have a parameter that says how much ambient light arrives here. And the purpose is just that if you have a surface point that does not receive any direct light, for instance, you have a light source, and we illuminate a sphere, then only these points here on the sphere receive direct light, and the rest should not be completely black. Yeah, because there's always some surrounding here that also reflects light, so light also comes to these parts indirectly. Yeah, so not to have a black surface here in the back, we add this ambient term. Okay, so that's just kind of constant that is added. More interesting is diffuse reflection. So diffuse reflection, we will come back to that, is the probably most simple lighting model. And diffuse reflection assumes that incident light hits a very rough surface, and light then is reflected on this rough surface multiple times so that it leaves that surface at an arbitrary random angle. That's perfect diffuse reflection. And there are many objects in reality that are almost diffuse, like paper, if it's not glossy paper, so more wallpaper-like. And several other materials have really diffuse reflectance. And this is very simple to describe, so we will see how to describe that. And then we have specular reflection, and that's reflection which is mirroring. Like a perfect mirror, but typically, there are many surfaces in reality that are not perfect mirrors, but they have little bumps, they have a little bit of roughness, and there not much internal reflection happens, but instead it's just that the reflected light is a bit scattered around the major or main reflection direction. This gives a glossy look. And this is what we call, or what is called in that model, specular. And this is diffuse. And then we have here this ambient part. OK, so these are three terms. And so this is just a simple image showing here a typical. So you recognize that plastic look. So that would be a Phong lighting applied to such a blob object. And now you have several components. The specular ones, these are these reflections here. So this gives these glossy highlights. Then we have the diffuse part. That tells us that since the object is more was brighter on the right, that obviously the light source is here on the right. And here on the back, it's almost dark, but it's not completely dark because there's also this ambient part. So these are the three components. OK, so a bit more in detail, in particular with formulas. Ambient light, as I said, objects that are not directly lit should still be visible, like the backside of the sphere. But there are also other examples if you would consider shadows or if you would have shadows included. For instance, in this scene here, it would be completely black under the table because there's no direct light arriving. This table blocks everything. But of course, it is not black. There is indirect light here. I can still see things. And this ambient light models that part. And this is just by adding a constant, essentially. Or more precisely, we take two terms. We have an intensity of a kind of global ambient light source. That's this here. And then every object in the scene gets a factor that says how much of this global ambient light is reflected. This is mainly, we will see very similar formula for the next light parts of the lighting model. So for consistency, we also here have the separation and material constant that can change per object, and that tells you how much ambient light is reflected from that, and a brightness of an ambient light source. So by increasing this part here, all objects get more ambient light, for instance, and by changing that factor, you can say that this particular object, for instance, should have less ambient light, so just for having more control. So, that's a result, and of course, it's extremely boring. So this is not, it is not a ring, but in fact, it's a torus. The round shape you cannot recognize at all because it has all uniform, the same color everywhere. So more interesting is diffuse reflection. An ideal diffuse reflector has a very rough surface at microscopic level. That's what I showed here. So when light arrives, it typically is multiple times reflected before it leaves the surface again. Yeah, and by this, any orientation gets lost from the illumination or the emission. Or the other way around. Yeah. So an incident photon is emitted into an arbitrary direction. And there are examples: chalk, matte paint, cloth, wood, not polished wood, but unfinished wood. These are typical diffuse material. Such surfaces are called Lambertian, because there was a physician, Lambert, who was one of the first to describe such the reflection of light, and he defined that such a kind of material. So these surfaces are still called Lambertian surfaces. And so one of the properties of such diffuse surfaces is that since the photons are emitted into any direction randomly, yeah, that such a surface doesn't change its appearance whatever angle I'm looking at. So for a diffuse surface, when I look at a particular point, the color of that point doesn't change with my viewing direction. Yeah? So at whatever angle I'm looking at that point, the color and the intensity or the brightness of that point is unchanged. So that works pretty well for chalk and stuff like that. And it's a simple way to find out whether an object is diffuse. So our lighting model becomes simpler because we don't have to take into account where the camera stands. Yeah, it's independent of the viewing position. And now Lambert found a very simple law that is also quite simple to explain for such diffuse reflectors, and that is that the reflection, the intensity of the reflection, decreases with a cosine of the direction of incidence, or of the angle of incidence. That means if such a surface is lit perpendicular, from a perpendicular direction, the maximum amount of light is emitted. Yeah? And the more you increase the angle of incidence, the less light is reflected. And if you're here at the horizon, then nothing is reflected anymore. And this is called Lambert's cosine law. It can also be visualized with such a sphere because it's one of the properties of the cosine. So if for each of these directions, now these are the directions of incidence, and if you scale each of these incident vectors with a cosine towards this main direction, all these points lie on the boundary of a sphere again. So that's all that's behind. It's just a visualization of the cosine function. And this can be, it's quite simple to explain that, in fact, that law. So let's assume you have a directional light source. And now the light source, the light emitted by that light source is described by single photons that are perfectly parallel. And they are uniformly distributed. Yeah. So here we have single photons that arrive here. Now if we look at that surface here, yeah, we see that one photon arrives every whatever this distance is. Now, if this very same light source illuminates a surface under a certain angle, yeah, then here we still have the same density in this direction. But here on the receiver, this distance here between these tips of the arrows will be larger than here. Yeah, it's just a geometric effect. And it's very simple. If you look at similar triangles, you will see that the increase in this distance is just the cosine of the angle of incidence. So that just means that less photons arrive per area. Yeah? So less energy arrives per area. That means less light arrives at a certain point. And that also means that less light can be reflected. Yeah? It's a very simple geometric property. It's the same effect why we have a different weather here from Africa. Yeah? Because typically in Europe, the light arrives at a much, smaller angle or larger angle than further south. So yeah, it's nothing magic. It's very simple to describe. And we can also easily describe that in our Phong model now. But for that, and I also already said so, to be able to describe that, we need at point x our surface normal. Yeah, so that surface normal is used to measure the angle of incidence. So for every point in our scene that we want to light, we also need to know the normal, the surface normal. And yeah, now if we know our point, we know the surface normal, we know the direction to the light source, let it be a parallel light source or a point light source, that doesn't make an incidence, that then we just need to compute the cosine of this angle in between the two. And yeah, I hope you know that we can simply do that by computing the dot product between n and l, as long as n has length 1. And since it's a normal vector, we can claim that. Yeah, we can say it's a direction, so it should have length 1. And l should not be the vector from the point to the light source, but the normalized direction. And if this is the case, if both have length 1, then the cosine of this angle is just the dot product in between. Yeah, so cosine's Lambert's law means the diffuse reflected light is proportional to the cosine. And then we have two other factors. Now this describes the intensity of the incident light. So it's the brightness of the light source. Yeah, it's this term that tells us how bright this light source is. And of course, if it's twice as bright, then the reflection is twice as high. That's simple. And this is a material parameter that tells us how much of the incident light is reflected diffusely. So that can be a factor between 0 and 1. Yeah, if it's 0, nothing at all is reflected diffusely. And if it's 1, then all incident light is reflected diffusely. In fact, such a material doesn't exist, I think. But yeah, if you have a very wide surface, then this is probably something like 95% or so. Okay, and that's already the formula. Both are equivalent, yeah? So that's already the formula for the first part, or for the second part, for the diffuse lighting. A little remark here, when you implement that, you might run into problems, because there's one simple thing. When computing the cosine of this angle, you have to be careful, because it's also, of course, possible that the light source is down here. Yeah, if you look at that sphere example, you have a normal that goes into this direction. Yeah, so this surface here is hit from the back. And yeah, in that case, you just have to be careful. If the dot product becomes negative, that means you have an angle larger than 90 degrees, then the dot product should be clamped to 0. And in fact, whenever we will have such a dot product in the following slides here, we assume that it's a clamped dot product. So if it becomes negative, it will be clamped to 0. And the same is true also for viewing directions, but typically then you don't see these points, or you look from the back, but okay, that's not that relevant. So now if we take our torus again and we add diffuse lighting, now you can see that it's a torus, yeah? Because now the color varies with the normal direction. And if we also add ambient light, you see that now it probably looks more natural, because also these dark regions here that receive no light at all, also these dark regions, they are still visible. They have no real shading in the sense that the color changes, but they are still visible. Whereas here, you cannot see the silhouette anymore, because this back part here is black anyhow. Okay, and then we have the specular reflection. So specular reflection, as I showed here, means light is reflected like off a mirror. But here now we have a very practical problem for our setup. Perfect mirror is very simple to describe. Yeah. And essentially, here in 2D, that would mean here we have our light source, here we have our camera, and now we have perfect reflection if this angle equals this angle. Yeah? So in our lighting model, we could write, so since this is L, this is N, and this is V, we could say if dot product L of N equals the dot product of V and N, then we return white, for instance, else black. Yeah, that would be a direct application of the law of reflection. But probably you can quickly recognize what the problem is. So here we compare angles. And the probability that the camera is really exactly in the reflection direction here is zero. On the computer, it's not zero because we don't have real numbers, but only quantized real numbers. But still, the probability is very, very, very small. Yeah, you really have to be exactly at the right position to see this reflection. So that doesn't make sense in our setup. So that's what Fong recognized. And so what he does instead is that he says, incident light here is not only reflected into this direction, but instead it's reflected or it's a little bit scattered around the main reflection direction. Yeah. So if we happen to be in that constellation, we receive the maximum amount of reflected light. And if we're a little bit off, we still receive light, but we receive less. Yeah. And by depending on how much the light is scattered, the corresponding highlights get smaller and larger. And visually, this looks like how rough is that surface that generates the specular reflection. Okay, so we assume again, like here for diffuse, that we have a kind of microstructure, but now this microstructure is not as bumpy as here. It's just slight variations in the surface, and as a result, the specular reflection is not perfect, but it's a bit scattered, but nevertheless, it still looks glossy and specular. And we get, it's not very elegant to go back here. Yeah, and so you see these specular highlights here. Yeah, these happen from this light scattering. Otherwise, we would just see a single white pixel somewhere here, or maybe no pixel. Yeah, and that's not what we want to have. Good, so how is this measured? To be able to model that, now we need the viewing direction. Yeah, because these specular highlights, they vary with a point of view. That's what I already said. Yeah, so at microscopic level, we have a smooth reflecting surface, and it's the light is reflected at that microgeometry. And the smoother the surface is, the closer we get to a perfect mirror. And now here again, the setup that I also already drawed at the blackboard. So we have our light source, we have a normal. Light comes in from here, is reflected. Now this is the perfect reflection direction. Yeah. And for our purpose now, if we look at that point with a camera from a direction V, which is close to R but not perfectly the same as R, then we can say the reflection depends on this angle. And the smaller this angle, yeah, the brighter this point will be, and the further we are away, the smaller the reflection will be. And I will skip that one. There's already slides that I already explained now, but I don't want to skip all these. Yeah. So if we would have perfectly specular objects, we wouldn't see anything, and also such perfect specular objects are not very common in nature. So it's really only perfect mirrors and chrome have this appearance. So more often are such softer reflections, yeah, where we have not perfect reflection, but a bit scattered reflection. And yeah, for now, we will assume that we have such a surface and not all light is reflected into that direction, but a bit more scattered. And this fall off is kind of visualized here. So what that shows is that if light comes from here, it is reflected, and this lobe here tells us how much light is reflected into the different directions. Yeah? And most light is reflected here in the reflection direction, and the further we get away, the less light is reflected. And modeling this fall off here now is, there are different ways to do that, and Fong's idea, yeah, which is not brilliant or whatever and not physically based, is very simple. So he takes the cosine of this angle. This is 1 if V and R are the same. So it's 1 if we want to have the maximum. And the further we are away from R, the smaller this cosine gets. Yeah? And now to model that fall off, he takes the cosine of this angle and takes it to the power ns. And ns is a material parameter. So what does this function generate? So let's do like that. If our angle is theta, yeah, the cosine looks like this. So the further we get away from the main reflection direction, yeah, the smaller this value gets. It even can become negative, but we don't care about that for now. And now we take it to the power of ns. So if we take that squared, for instance, the function will look like this. If we take it to the fifth, it will look like that. Okay, that's a bit exaggerated. Yeah, and the higher this exponent gets, the sharper this peak will get. And essentially, that's just the way to model that drop-off. Yeah? So if we take a large exponent here, yeah, then there will be, if we move away from the main direct reflection direction, there will be a very fast drop-off. Yeah? So from here, we won't see anything anymore. Yeah? This cosine here will have, or this function here will have dropped to zero, or to almost zero. And if ns is not so big, if we have, for instance, this function here, then we get a larger highlight. Yeah, so that's a very simple way to model that. And again, we have a cosine in here, but it's another cosine. For the diffuse term, we have the cosine of this angle. Oh, and that one is wrong. Okay. So it should be phi, right? Oh, this is another keyboard. Yeah, that's better. Yeah, for the cosine, for the diffuse term, we have the cosine of this angle, and now we have to look at the cosine of this angle. Yeah, so it's something different, and then we take it to the power ns, and this ns is a surface constant. So that means it's a constant that is defined per object, and it just tells us how glossy is that object. The larger ns, the more glossy it is, and the smaller, the less glossy it is. And then here in front we have the other terms, like for the diffuse and ambient. So we have the intensity of the light source, and so this is a parameter of the light source, and this is a parameter of the surface again. It tells us how much of the light is reflected in the specular mode. Yeah? So for specular reflection, we have the material parameters k spec and ns. So it's two parameters. Yeah? And for diffuse, we only have the diffuse reflection parameter. Okay. So this model has no physical basis at all. Yeah, it's just a way to describe that fall off. And there are other models that, for instance, use a Gaussian on this angle. Yeah, so we take a Gaussian function, and they have mathematical. These also have no physical basis, but from a mathematical point of view, they are sometimes easier to handle in terms to invert them or stuff like that. But this is the most widely used model. Okay. So how can we compute that? Quite simple. We need the cosine of this angle, and for this we can again take the dot product between R and V. Yeah, so that's the cosine of this angle here, and the reflection direction, just as a remark, how to compute that is also not too difficult. So if you assume that we have a vector L, N, and R, as shown here, they are all unit vectors. And then we can say that if we replace or if we add L to R, then we would be back on the normal direction. This is only possible if this angle and this angle are the same. Yeah? So we can say that R plus L are a multiple of n, and in fact how much we have to stretch n to get here, we can also compute because we can project L onto n. The length of this can be computed by the dot product. Yeah, this is n dot product with L. This gives us this length, and twice this length brings us exactly to here. So we can say R plus L must be L projected onto n. That's this, twice. Yeah? And if we resolve that for R, we get this formula here for the reflection direction. Yeah? So it's a dot product and a multiplication and a difference, so it's not very complicated to compute. Yeah? So that means R, so because we are only given N, L, and V, yeah? The light direction, view direction, and the surface normal, and from L and N we can compute R, and if we know R, we can take the dot product with V, and this gives us the specular cosine. Okay, so now let's add this. So for our torus, if we only have specular reflection, we get this here, and if we add this to ambient light and diffuse, we get this here. Now this is the final result of Phong lighting. Here again, the influence of the exponent in that model. That's essentially the same image that I've drawn here already. So you see, for the larger this exponent gets, the thinner the reflection area becomes. Yeah, and it's nobody uses here such small exponents. So a typical exponent would be something like 10 or 20 or 50 or so. Yeah, even 100 still gives you well visible highlights. So don't be afraid to choose a large exponent. The fall off isn't that fast. Yeah, and a small exponent means it's a rather diffuse, where diffuse is not really the right word. And a large NS gives you a glossy surface. And one other thing that can be seen here is that typically it makes sense to select a specular coefficient that is white or that has no color at least. Yeah, like in this example, you see the ring is kind of bluish or cyan or something like that. But here the specular highlight is white. And this is the right way to do that, because the typical model that can be used is that plastic typically looks like that. It has a rather smooth surface, yeah? And it's the material is transparent, the main material. And inside that material, there are little pieces
little colored pieces that give the color to the object.
Yeah, so these are colored. And now if light comes in, there are two possibilities, or three. Either it's absorbed, yeah, then you don't have to care, or it's reflected off this slightly bumpy surface, so this gives you the specular term, and this is white, because this light doesn't even see that colored particles down there, or the light here is scattered into that surface and is scattering around here, and then it receives the light of the particles and it's emitted into an arbitrary direction, and that's the diffuse part. And because it happens from scattering at these particles, this one is colored then. Yeah? Yeah?
This color is not white, it's color of the light source.
Is yeah, of course. I mean, yes. But it's this material parameter. This material parameter should be white or not colored. Yeah? And if the incident light then, of course, has some color, I should have. yeah, computing with colors. So one point here is that, let's say your specular color is white. Yeah, we really describe it as an RGB triple. Now, the light from the color of the light source. But the light source is red. So you have this color, for instance. Yeah? Then this multiplication here just means a component-wise multiplication. That means k spec times I then is red again. Yeah? It's really just multiplication is done component-wise on the different channels separately. Yeah, so if you have a white surface and you illuminate it by red light, then it will become red, of course. And in fact, yeah, maybe it's a good time to speak about that. A problem that appears here in that context is the following. If you have green material, now let's say we take the diffuse part. Yeah. Now, if you have a green material and you illuminate it with red light, then the resulting color will be black. And this is something you don't see in reality, or typically don't see. And that problem, that's a problem of that simplification that I spoke before. If you look at these functions here, you see that red and green overlap very well. So even if you take a light source that has this spectrum, the kind of perfect green spectrum of your eye, and you illuminate it with red, then you have a significant overlap. Yeah? So this frequency, for instance, yeah, is both perceived as red, as part of red and green. So it contributes to the red and to the green channel. So if you take a green light, yeah, and illuminate such a red surface, you will very well see a reflection. But this is ignored in this model, yeah? Because it really separates these color channels. Essentially, it takes a model that looks like this, that red is just a part of the frequency domain, like this. Yeah? Green is that function, and blue is that function. And if I now take blue light onto a perfectly red surface, there's no overlap. Yeah, you will have no reflection. But yeah, with this model, you wrongly get this result here. Yeah, so this color handling is very, 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 very approximate. And if you have a very good, whatever, rendering program, ray tracer, or whatsoever, it will not use just RGB for the computations and for describing the reflections, but have something much more complicated and subdivide the frequency range into many bands, whatever, 20 bands, and have multiple color values and do the reflection computations with these many bands, and then in the end transform to RGB. And you will get something different. Yeah?
Wouldn't a quick fix be
For which example?
The second one.
Yeah?
Yes.
No, but this is multiplication, it's not addition. Yeah, so that would mean, okay, let's put it the other way around in your model. If you take a white surface, yeah, and you illuminate it with no light, yeah, so the result must be zero. But in your model, it would be 0.5, 0.5, 0.5. That also wouldn't work. It's a fundamental problem. Yeah? OK, I don't want to. It's not that important. We will ignore that for now. It's just, it just fits here. OK, good. So yeah, here, again, other examples for this exponent here. So you see, even for an exponent of 50, you still have a significant highlight. And the smaller the exponent gets, the larger the highlight. I mean, this is already quite unnatural, I would say. And yeah, the exponent of 0 is crap. That's nonsense. That doesn't make sense. And there's also another thing. OK, yeah, I can already point out here. Again, there will be the slide for that later on. If you look at that, you realize that obviously here, much more light is reflected than here. Yeah, just from an energy point of view. I mean, the brightest spot here and here is the same, but here the reflection goes over a much larger region. So from an energy point of view, a much larger fraction of the incident light is reflected here than here, and that's that makes this model physically very implausible. And in fact, even for small coefficients, it's easy to show that more light is reflected than is coming in. So it's not even energy conservation works for that simple model. And in fact, what should be is that if the highlight gets thinner or smaller, so that means if the exponent becomes bigger, then the reflected light should be brighter. Yeah, we should also, in a more physical model, would also scale the reflection according to that coefficient. Okay, but I will have a remark on this later on. Okay, so now we have the Phong lighting model. We know the single parts, ambient, diffuse, specular. So the reflection is just the sum of these. And now if we have multiple lights, then we can see, okay, the ambient part is independent of the number of lights. And the other terms, the diffuse and the specular reflection, they appear for each of the light sources. Yeah? So we have to sum over all the light sources and have to sum the diffuse and the specular part. And the color or the intensity of the incident light can be pulled in front of the braces here. And then we get this term here. Yeah? So this is now for multiple lights. OK, so there is an optimization that is quite often used. And if you look at example shader code, for instance, that does these computations, it's very likely that you don't find that real plain Phong model as I described it here, but instead a variant that is called the Blinn Phong model. And here the idea is the following. If we look at that picture again, it's only about the specular term. And if you look at that picture again, you see, you will remember that this is the angle that controls the specular term, phi. Yeah? And computing that phi is, it's not really complicated in terms of today's hardware, but at the time these models have been developed, it was really every addition that counted. And so there was an alternative proposed. Instead of measuring this angle to measure how far we are away from the main direction, another possibility is the following. So we compute the so-called halfway vector between L and V. So the halfway vector is just the direction in between L and V. Yeah, it is the sum of L and V normalized again. Yeah, so this vector H is just between L and V. And now if we have perfect reflection between L and V, then H would be the same as N. Yeah? If H and N are equivalent, then L and V are, or there's V is the perfect reflection of L. So instead of measuring this angle, we could also measure this angle between N and H. Yeah? This also gives us an approximation. How far are we away from the main reflection direction? And now this is a bit simpler because H this depends on how the hardware is generated. Yeah? H involves a normalization, which is normally quite expensive. But what is possible is that if we have a directional light source L, and we have, or we make the assumption that this vector V is also constant, that we always look from the same direction into our scene, then we can pre-compute this H for the entire scene, and then we just have a single dot product. Yeah, that was from the very old times, where really every arithmetic operation was important. It's a pretty rough approximation, but it is still quite often used. Yeah? That we say V, the view direction is constant, the light direction is constant, and then this halfway vector can be pre-computed, and then we have this single dot product to compute that angle. Yeah, it's ancient, but it's still often used. Okay, so here's some plots now for the entire reflection function. So what these plots show is, so here at the center down here of this hemisphere, this is the point being illuminated. And then we have the single reflections as a polar plot in the given direction. So the ambient part is always just very, very little ambient reflection. Then the diffuse part is independent of the direction. So this gives a hemisphere. And the specular part is a lobe that goes into the main reflection direction. So the light comes from here, and then we have this specular lobe that describes the specular reflection, and these are just the sums of all of these. Again here, such spheres showing the influence. So this is when we change the direction of the light source, or the position of the light source, so you see that the highlight is moving. Yeah? And if we vary the exponent, then you see that the highlight is shrinking. And again here, plastic, the specular coefficient should be white, and the diffuse exponent is the diffuse color, the color of the plastic, what we describe as color. Now, again, I said that before. One interesting thing is that when NS gets larger, the highlights get smaller but not brighter. This is physically not correct. And in particular, it is what also does not happen is that if you increase NS more and more, that you get a perfect mirror surface. Because all that we mirror is the light source. Yeah? And to get a real mirror, you have to do much more complicated things so that you see one object mirroring or being mirrored in another one. Yeah, then you need much more complicated lighting models. And also another thing, if NS is 1, then the specular term is not the same as the diffuse term. It's just the angle is different. Yeah, the diffuse term is the angle between light direction and normal, and for the specular term, it's the angle between the reflection direction and the view direction. So it's two different angles. Okay, so now what we are still missing, if you think a little bit about that, is one pretty important effect, and that's the following. If I take a light source, and I illuminate a surface, let's say I take a whatever light, and I illuminate that surface, obviously the illumination or the lighting depends on how far I'm away from that surface. Yeah, the closer I get, the brighter the illumination here gets. And this is what we haven't modeled yet. But this one is hidden in this term I in that we always use. So if I go back a little bit, here you see that I'm writing about the incident light from light source I. Yeah? And so this is not really the brightness of the light source, but this really describes how much of this light source does arrive at my point X, and how much the light is attenuated from the way from the light source to my point. Yeah, this is called attenuation. And now we have to differentiate two parts. The first thing is, if we have a directional light, like from light source, like from sun, then the incident light is independent. So we don't have the light source is infinitely far away. Yeah, so we cannot measure distance to that light source. And also for sun, if there would be sunlight, then an illumination here is exactly the same like here. Yeah, it doesn't make a difference how close I'm to the sun. So in that case, we can keep it constant. Otherwise, if we have a point light, physics tell us that there's a quadratic fall off. So that means if I double the distance to the light, only 1/4 of the energy is arriving. Yeah? So physics would tell us that I in, the incident light, is I. That's now really the intensity or the brightness of the light source over the distance squared. So that's what physics tells us. But if you look at images generated with that, you will realize that they look implausible. Yeah, this looks wrong. It's a too strong fall off. This has several reasons. One reason is that we do not account for indirect lighting. And indirect, if we would account for indirect lighting, we have, in general, more uniform distribution of light, and such a hard fall off contradicts to that. Yeah? So it emphasizes this fact that we ignore indirect lighting. Another effect is that typically the colors that we have in the frame buffer are not proportional to the color that is really emitted physically. Yeah? It's like a film in a camera, or even in a digital camera. If in one pixel you have a value of 100, and in another pixel you have a value of 50, that does not mean that in reality that value was twice as bright as this one. There is a mapping in the camera that maps radiance, so that's the physical unit to measure light, to the value in the image, yeah, to the pixel value. And this function typically looks like that. Yeah, so it's nonlinear. And using that model again contradicts to that. So it overemphasizes all that. So of course people realize that, and because to do a real complete physical simulation is much more too complicated, a simple solution or workaround is to do the following, that the fall off is not modeled by 1 over distance squared, but instead a polynomial is used. Yeah, 1 over C0 plus C1d plus C2d squared. And d is the distance to the light source. And these are parameters that can be chosen by the user. So this is absolutely non-physical. Yeah? This has nothing to do with physics. But it's a way to work around all these problems. But of course, it shows that positioning a light source, you cannot just say, okay, I want to have a 50-watt light bulb here at that position, and that's it. But instead, you also have to model these parameters, and of course, they are scene-dependent. Yeah, they depend on how far the objects or how big your scene is, and so on. So it's a lot of tweaking to get the right results. Yeah, so this is all not physically based. I hope I emphasized that often enough. And later on, we will come back and see how physics describes all that and how we can do that physically based. But then you will also see that things become much more complicated. Okay. So this is the Phong lighting model, and it has many shortcomings. And in fact, it's a problem that is, of course, in physics very well known, not only in computer graphics, but also in physics. So there are many, many people that tried to find out how do surfaces reflect light. And many models were developed, and these models can become arbitrarily complex. One model that we want to describe here is one that is also used in computer graphics quite often, and it's called the model of Torrance and Sparrow. And we will describe it here because it's quite simple still to describe, and it just should show you that there are many other models around. And the idea now here is that, again, we have that model that we have a rough surface that reflects light. Yeah? And now the roughness of the surface describes how diffuse and how specular the light is. It's very simple to similar to what I've already shown here. And now here's the corresponding image. So we model a smooth, in this case, planar surface, but in fact, there's a microscopic structure of the surface. Yeah? And the more bumpy the surface is, the more light, reflected light, is off the perfect reflection direction. So if we look at that point, for instance, yeah, the global surface has this normal, but the microscopic surface has this normal. So if a photon comes here, it is reflected into this direction, yeah, which does not fit with that normal, but with this little local normal. So this is called a microfacet model or whatever microscopic surface model that locally, if you take a microscope, you realize that the surface looks different than the surface that we model. Yeah? So it has more structure. And now the idea of Torrance-Sparrow is just a way to model this roughness and to describe how this model influences the reflection. And now this is the result. And essentially, the important thing are these three terms here, D, F, and G. Yeah, so these are, one could simply skip these. I will come back to these in a minute. But these are the three important terms. It's the distribution of normals, the Fresnel term, and the geometry term. And yeah, what do they mean? D just describes... So these, again, all the vectors we will use in the following, we've seen most of them. And the important thing is now we have a surface, a global surface normal, and a local surface normal. So this is the one of our rough surface, n prime. And alpha is the inclination, how far are we off the major normal. And we can define the roughness of a surface now by describing a distribution of these alphas. Yeah? If for every surface point alpha is zero, then we have a perfectly flat surface. And if we have a distribution where larger alphas appear, we will see these images in a second, like this, for instance, then that means an inclination of whatever this angle is here, 45 degrees, has still a given probability. Yeah, so it tells us how likely it is that that we have a certain inclination. And the more this is focused to 0 degrees, the flatter this is. I just realized that I won't be able to to finish that today. Why all these dot products appear here in that particular version. So we will do that on Thursday. And we will see again on Thursday at 12:30, right? That was the time that we decided about last time. Okay, so see you next Thursday. Thank you.